welcome to the Accelerating Operational Performance podcast. I'm Greg Schenkel from Unique Training and Development and Frontline Leadership Systems. And as always in the podcast, our goal is to bring you the value that you need in your career journey, in your organization's success in terms of the projects that you're working on, and just generally how to get better results with the same level of effort and hopefully less stress and frustration. This episode is actually brought to you by our new Site Leader Development Program. This is a program that we have for plant managers, distribution center managers, really on how to properly empower their team to make the day-to-day decisions so that as senior leaders, they can work on the things that are even higher value to the organization. And of course, if you're interested in more, you can visit us at uniquedevelopment.com. Today, I get to interview a colleague of mine, Lauren Kelton, and I've been looking forward to this because Lauren and I have served in leadership roles within the Canadian Association of Professional Speakers. And so we both have served as president of that organization. We've served on a number of committees together. So I've really seen Lauren in operation in a number of leadership roles. And I was also intrigued about his business. So let me properly introduce Lauren to you, and then we'll enter into our dialogue together. So Lauren Kelton, for more than 25 years, Lauren is the founder of ThinkShift Performance Solutions, Inc., and he's been helping organizations elevate their leadership, critical thinking, and employee engagement skills through a disciplined approach to managerial effectiveness. Lauren's expertise has been trusted by numerous clients looking to leverage their human capital to achieve their strategic business objectives. He's known for his direct, no-nonsense style in improving workplace productivity and interpersonal relationships, a true master motivator. And if that wasn't enough, he's also a published author of 5 books, including iFrame, A Manager's Guide to Critically Balanced Thinking. And when he's not consulting, he can be found producing independent films focused on social justice, including the award-winning Companionless. Lauren, welcome to the show.
Oh, great to be here, Greg. Thank you.
Yeah, and if anyone needs to reach out to Lauren, of course, the easiest way to do that is through his website, thinkshift.com. And you can also, of course, find him on LinkedIn by just searching his name, Lauren Kelton. And Lauren, because we've worked together for a while, I was always an admirer of your business model. It's different from ours. We do a lot of frontline leadership training in manufacturing and operations environments. And one of the things that I know that you do is you do a much deeper dive to get down to, I guess, what you might call some form of truth that the organization itself might not even know. So can you describe a little bit about the work that your firm does with its clients?
Sure. And maybe the best way to do that in a nutshell without being too verbose, which I can be guilty of, I think it's the rationale for really looking for what the meat on the bones is started with when you and I first started with the Professional Speaking Association. Both of us were probably doing a lot more stage work, keynote speaking, that kind of thing. And what I had noticed, Greg, over a period of 4 or 5 years was an emptiness that I was feeling when I would deliver a 45-minute piece, for example, on, let's say, employee engagement, and always wondering after the fact, is anybody in the audience actually going to put any of this to use? And you probably have that experience with maybe even today with your workshops, but it was a lingering thing and it always bothered me. And it made it feel as if the money that I was earning was dirty in a sense, and that, like I say, an emptiness. And so what happened naturally by osmosis was a desire to want to get inside those organizations that were paying me to speak on a specific topic and see whether or not the content of that talk had any real value on the front lines. Yeah. You know, was it just airy-fairy stuff, or did it have a practical application? And to this day, it's something I think about whenever I see someone speaking on a given topic. How is that translating back on the job? So that was the genesis of wanting to see, am I actually worth my salt?
I'm curious. I mean, I want to interrupt you on that one because
sure.
I think every practitioner of any kind in whatever the discipline is, you know, always thinks, oh, if only I was embedded, if I was in that organization or even a member of their management team, I would be able to affect even greater change. And I think sometimes people don't realize that when you do get embedded, if you were to actually join the management team of that organization, yeah. you'd be subjected to all the politics and things that are going on inside. Right. You're kind of in this, you're still able to take this independent role, being an external advisor, consultant, but you do get yourself embedded. And also, it strikes me that there might have been a little, at least a little bit at first, of this fear of, hey, I'm gonna stick my neck out. I'm gonna get involved in the implementation. And boy, oh boy, this is gonna either prove that what I've got works and adds value or it doesn't. I just wondered if you could comment on that, like that that first assignment, that first project when you decide to go deeper.
Yes, a tremendous amount of trepidation and fear, but. The downside was that I would never do business with that client again, perhaps, if I didn't produce the results, and I could go on to the next one and learn from that experience without hopefully too much background chatter. Thankfully, the first assignment goes back quite a number of years that I had independently was in the financial services sector with a major Canadian bank, and it was in the customer service arena, the topic. So it was something that was a soft topic. But what I wanted to do was say, okay, are the employees actually aware of the impact that their behaviors, their actual tangible behaviors are having on the front line with their customers? So yes, there was trepidation, but thankfully I was on a topic in an environment that I was really comfortable with. So at least I wasn't dealing with the weight of image. I wasn't dealing with the weight of credibility in terms of knowing their business.
Gotcha.
But I had to earn the respect of the employees by mitigating their fear.
Right.
Because the fear in my environments, Greg, really isn't so much my own. It is the people that I have to deal with, especially if it's a more senior executive type C-suite person who absolutely does not want me to be there.
Oh, interesting. I want to come back on for a minute because I think actually I probably derailed you when I was asking about those first assignments, but I think the audience needs to know the kind of deep dive you get into, which is kind of behind your comment here about the executives getting uncomfortable sometimes.
Yeah.
Can you share something about the thoroughness of your process? Because I think you get, when I said you get closer to the truth than most people do, it's because you're not getting the superficial answers you might get in a group meeting.
Right.
Can you just comment on some of the diligence that you and your team go through when you're on one of your assignments?
It starts with getting permission from stakeholders, usually the person who has engaged me for that project as a consultant. This can be multi-week or multi-month, getting their permission to be able to peel back the layers of the proverbial onions, behaviorally speaking. Without that commitment from senior management, I can't do my job. So I cannot engage on any project if I don't have full transparency with the stakeholders. Once that's given, which it always is if we do move forward, then I have the luxury of time to sit individually with the people who are going to participate in that program to try and mitigate what their fears are and what they're coming to the table wanting and not wanting. And that means direct one-on-one discussions, letting them know, and perhaps the single biggest effective tool that I use in my work is letting them know that if I were in their shoes, I would be feeling exactly the same way in terms of resistance. And then we get into what the specific behaviors are. You have to understand, Greg, in a lot of situations, the people that I'm working with are compelled by their supervisors or by their senior management to be a part of the program. Mm-hmm. So if I'm doing a behavioral leadership workshop, for example, most of the people in that room have to be there, not by choice. So you can imagine what the resistance level on their.
So what you're saying is they can be a little hostile at times. I mean, or at least defensive, let's say, not necessarily forthcoming, because they're concerned about, I'm guessing there's just this fear of loss. Either the loss of perceived control over the status quo and what's been successful for them so far, or some other potential loss that they'll be exposing and look bad either to you or to their management in the reports.
Right.
I had to remember that you're still talking about behavioral changes. I thought sometimes it sounds like you dig deeper into the behavioral changes and how they're impacting elements of the business operations. Is that correct?
Very much so. Yeah. Okay. I'm interested in looking at what are the specific behaviors that those individuals who are driving the organization in most cases, what are those behaviors? What do they look like and why are they causing them the challenges that have been identified and why I've been brought in the first place? And usually that'll go through an HR process, it'll go through a self-reflection process, but at some point there's a wall that has been hit. So when I work with them, what I'm trying to do is peel back one of four clusters. I'll be looking at what are they doing with their teams by way of their critical thinking? Mm-hmm. What are they doing with respect to the development piece, the achieving piece, and the execution piece?
Those are four very good areas that really link to whatever the outcomes are that they're getting, both positive or negative.
Correct.
Can you share maybe an example? Again, we're not going to name names here to protect both the innocent and the guilty, but I'm curious whether you can just walk us through a successful intervention and maybe including any sort of insights that the company didn't know and wouldn't have known without that kind of a deep intervention. Does something come to mind?
There's quite a few. It can get very emotional as well. You know, you hit the nail on the head when you talk about behaviors. The assumption is that we're dealing with emotional reactions to incidents that have happened. And this is kind of why if we get into the filmmaking side of things later in the conversation, there's direct correlation between, you know, the stories we tell ourselves and the stories that our direct reports see. Mm-hmm. And the living, breathing examples that I see, and one that I can share with you, would be the example of a senior executive, a general manager at a mining company. We do a lot of work in the mining sector, for example, who was absolutely, unequivocally the top in class when it came to process engineering, but who had a team of almost 300 people, including senior leaders, who were unable to approach him, unable to ascertain what was expected of them. Simple stuff, 101 behavioral stuff. And this manager, this senior executive, was of the opinion that those soft skills did not matter, that the core competencies that he brought to the table was what he was being paid for, and not necessarily to manage and assuage the fears of the people, you know, that are reporting to him.
Can I ask you a question?
Please.
Because
please.
Let's say that person had some blind spots related mm-hmm. to, you know, again, understanding the expectations, because they're probably feeling that they're delivering on the metrics and things that are expected of them.
Yeah.
Was the need for that person to change identified either by HR or by someone above them, and they just had trouble buying into the fact that they needed to change?
Even more than that, yes, HR is often involved, but HR has its limitations. And I don't want to go down that rabbit hole because my view of what role the HR department plays in these large organizations is very different than what I think the general public thinks an HR department role is.
Yeah.
And the HR role can be extremely biased in favor of certain groups within the organization.
Right.
So in my case, the folks I work with, those blind spots, as you say, have already been identified. Mm-hmm. And yet they've hit a roadblock. And the company is often in a position, Greg, where either A, they have to part company with that individual just because of the sheer number of complaints, for example, that might be levied against them for all kinds of reasons, or to ignore and let that blind spot continue. Mm-hmm. And they engage my services when they say, we're not ready to part with this person. They're part of our long-term succession plan. They're right. extremely valuable. They've been with us for 17 years, but they can't work with Joe, Mary, or whatever.
Yeah.
And it's
yeah.
So that's where it gets very interesting. And I'm able to put myself in their shoes because I've been through so many of these environments and seen these issues so often. You get to hold a mirror up to that and say, this blind spot is arguably going to be your downfall potentially.
So let me ask you, just again, within the context, because you're giving us some really good detail here, is that just one focal individual in what might be a larger intervention, or is that literally the focus of your intervention is just helping that person shift?
It depends what the project requirements are. If it is specific to one, some projects are based exclusively on one individual. Okay. And therefore, the approach is much more of a coaching capacity. Mm-hmm. But even in those instances, Greg, I'm on site with them. I am living and breathing in their spaces. I'm in their office literally with them. I'm taking their phone calls with them. Okay. When they get up and move down the hall to go and see their direct report, I am with them and next to them. It's a very invasive process, which a lot of people are not comfortable with. And if you've ever had the chance to do these kind of day in life studies, it's extremely difficult for the other party.
Oh, yeah. I just wanted to mention, because I'm sure our audience can appreciate that. So it's one thing to meet with a coach and just have an hour or 2 hour long session and just the two of you hash it out, because then your coach only really hears your filtered version of whatever the problem is. But if you said, oh, you know, we're going to follow you along. I always think it's almost like in sports. Imagine that everything you did in the day could be replayed over and over again, and people could either see the awesomeness that you had or the boneheaded mistakes that you made. And what you're trying to do is just get a version of the truth so that when you have the follow-up conversation to all that observation, you're able to share, here's what I noticed. Did you notice that? How did you perceive that conversation went? And so continue on. Yeah, this is fascinating.
Well, what you've said is exactly the flow. And to add a little bit more meat on the bones, because it comes back to your original question about and by the way, I love the term truth that you're using. It's not a term that I employ in day to day, but that is in fact what we're trying to get to. When I'm with these individuals, I'm taking old school style, because I can't do it on a tablet in real time, but I'm writing down copious amounts of notes. I will end a day probably with 50, 60 pages of notes on our interactions, if that's the project that I've just described to you. I let the party that I'm working with know, as part of the mitigation strategy, that if ever at any point they want to see the notes I'm taking, they're welcome. If they can read my chicken scratch, they're welcome to, and I'll turn my book over to them and they can look at it and they can evaluate, and they'll occasionally do that. Most won't, but
yeah, I think even making the offer is good, because what it says is, I'm not writing, I think, you know, if you've ever watched movies with a therapist or whatever, and they're writing down notes and the person's talking, what are you writing down there? Are you writing down stuff about me that you're not going to tell me? And so I think it's just good for you to have set that expectation up front, that if you're ever curious what I'm writing down, I'm happy to share it, because there's nothing I'm writing down that I am not sharing with you, or at least not folding into some recommendation. You know, around what'll make it better. So I know we're embedded, and I'm glad we're going in these small bunny trails off to the side. So this person, that assignment that you were thinking of, was in that sort of closed-minded point of view. Kind of help us understand then, how did that person sort of come around? Because I think it must have been a breakthrough for it to be a success.
Keep in mind, Greg, that the scenario I've described to you, as real as it is, for the person being evaluated, and for the people that we interact with over the course of the day together, their direct reports, let's say, or on the shop floor, for them, it's not real. It's not truthful. It is contrived to a certain degree. And that's normal. That's to be expected. So I know that. And when I write all these notes out, whether they choose to read them or not, those notes have to translate into observations and recommendations. If I were to assume that what I'm seeing in the life of that individual is their truth for the day, well, in order to assume that there's truth there, I need to be able to go back to the people who we interacted with during the day. So if we did get up and we went down the hall, we saw Joe and we discussed something, how much has that been feigned or altered because of my presence? Yeah. I will go back and I'll see Joe independently, like his direct report.
This is a key thing, because what you're saying is when under observation, I think scientists have a name for that, but it's like, so when you're observing something, it could, by the very observation, could be affecting it. So you're saying you actually kind of work back in an iterative fashion to see if there's more to the story related to that.
Well, that's correct. And the backdrop to this is the critical thinking piece, which has its own formula. That's what the whole iframe thing that you alluded to in the introduction, this iframe process, which, again, if time permits, I'm happy to touch on that a little bit. But there's an underpinning critical thinking process that has a few steps to it that are applied to these daily interactions. And once, let's say, a day has finished and that individual has interacted with half a dozen people, the total picture helps isolate the truth of the matter.
Yeah.
And then that information can be weighed against, why was I brought in the first place? In other words, mm-hmm. were the concerns about that individual, are they warranted? Are they truthful? Yeah. And the ultimate decision about what to do about it rests with the company, of course. But it gets graphed. All those notes get put into a spreadsheet. The spreadsheet produces actual graphs. And it drills down to everything from productivity to tones of voice to dismissiveness, and whether or not the complaints that are levied against that person are in fact happening. And by interviewing their direct reports individually, it can corroborate or not, what the initial concerns were.
Hey, I think what people maybe, again, people will use 360 evaluations. You're essentially conducting a 360 evaluation without necessarily numerical surveys, but you're turning those observations into things that can be quantified. I think that's a powerful difference. And maybe I never really asked you why the name of the company is Think Shift, but I'm picking up on it as I like hear about the process. And so in that individual you were talking about, it sounds like you must have had a breakthrough after they saw sort of the insurmountable, undeniable evidence.
Yes, to a certain degree. There's always going to be, especially with the alpha characters, male or female, a defensiveness that is somewhat impenetrable. But if you can hold up the mirror and show what the consequence of specific behaviors are, this led to this, this therefore that, mm-hmm. That generally is accepted. And that is the door that opens. And then it's up to them how far they want to take it, how deep they want to go. And in some cases, they like the breakthrough. They didn't like it at first. But if they buy into it, what that can lead to for both them and for myself and the company is a longer-term relationship. And that's why so much of our work is referral-based now, because they say, those are the people that actually sit and talk to us and peel things back and actually have conversations with us.
Yeah, to add to that, my own experience is that I was with a client recently, and I have to admit, I've been doing this for more than 30 years. And yeah. So there gets to be a time when you, at least for me, when you sort of say, I've seen, X number of factories, I've seen X number of distribution centers. I don't really have to go and see because I can generalize what it is. But recently I decided, no, I need to go back to the roots of walking the floor, talking to people. And I had found, at least for us, drifting away from that is not as effective as going through. And I saw this VP in operations, and she said, it's very refreshing to hear that you actually just want to go and walk the floor and talk to the supervisors before even making a recommendation of what a program might be. And I think you're getting that same thing. What I'm at an even deeper level, the other comment I'd make is aggressive defensive people, which you're describing that person as aggressive defensive, they really respect two things above all the other things. They respect directness, and they respect data or information or evidence. And so it sounds like you're really hitting them with that double whammy of both things. You're being very direct with them, but you're also giving them numerical data, which, again, aggressive people appreciate. And it allows them to change their mind based on that directness and that data.
That's correct. And I'll tell you something else that really is an overarching principle here. And I'd be curious, Greg, if you run into this as well. And that is, just being listened to, as basic as that is, and as intellectually curious as I am, and I know you are, we think, oh, that's all 101 stuff. Let's get to the 201 and 301. It keeps coming back to the 101 in terms of a senior general manager telling you, nobody's ever talked to me like that. And they'll say it to you in very simple terms. And these are people with a depth of knowledge and degrees out the wazoo who know their job really well. But the emotional, tangible, touchable side, not to be too soft in the term, nobody talks to me like that. My boss doesn't talk to me like that. HR doesn't approach me that way. So I think there's a real need to recognize that the most senior of managers, in order to execute the strategies that have been put in front of them, need to feel wanted. They need to feel cared for, if I can say it that way.
I heard it put it a slightly different way recently. It said that even people who are living through some sort of dysfunction of some kind, they still have this truth inside them of whatever their situation is. They're still a good person. They're still, like anybody, wanting to be successful, wanting to be a hero. And it's really, you're really helping them through your process navigate that path to getting back on the you know, here's how you could bring out even more of all your strengths and yeah. successes without the negative consequences. So I'm curious, I mean, you can expand on that a bit more if you want, but what I was curious of is if you're dealing a group, so that sounds like a very intensive intervention for a senior leader. I'm wondering, and your point, and by the way, your point, I wanted to acknowledge your point about being listened to. You know, a lot of coaching is simply letting people talk through whatever the problem is, and at least being heard as they're talking through. And then the best answers, of course, are the ones that they articulate or at least accept from what you're suggesting. What do you do in the case where you might be doing a management team? Yeah. How does your process differ from what you just described?
Great question. When it's a group setting, and let's say I'll take critical thinking because that's really my core competency when I'm working within an organization. Group work will often center around critical thinking. And the reason that's so powerful is because you're dealing with feelings, reflecting on those feelings, surfacing of assumptions and biases, which are usually at the root of most of the problems I come across in most of the businesses I work with. And it's the meaning that they attach to the assumptions they have, to the biases they have, how they interpret that, that if you can get to that point, that message can be shared globally and in a group setting. Yeah. And then you can, you know, parachute in very specific examples, either from that company or another company, even better, to say, and what they identify with is, oh, yeah, okay, that sounds like me. You know, oh, I've been through that situation. You're giving them enough examples from real world environments that mirror their own that they can hopefully identify with. And the critical thinking principles that I try to bring to the table are, I think, the most valuable pieces of learning that we have in our toolbox. Because it's not supported by most organizations. They don't have the time or the wherewithal to bring that to the table.
Yeah, no, that's very good. I do want to get to, well, first of all, let's talk about your book. So the book is iFrame, A Manager's Guide to Critically Balanced Thinking. Right. And we're talking to Lauren Kelton from thinkshift.com. So Lauren, we won't have time to go obviously through all the different scenarios or the different parts of your model. If you had to highlight one or two elements of your iFrame model, what would you say has the biggest impact?
What's been most valuable across the last decade, Greg, is simply having people pay attention, literally pay attention to events that trigger emotional reactions at work. And it applies in their personal life as well, but we won't go there for today. That's not where I focus. But every day, each of those managers is subject to something that's triggering them. And I say trigger, it doesn't have to be a big explosive trigger, but there's some type of inciting incident, as I call it, that triggers some type of emotional reaction. So the model is very effective at encouraging managers and senior folk to pay attention to any incident or event that triggers some type of emotional reaction. If we can get to that point, then it's been served to us on a platter. If we can find the time, take that incident, and now we can deconstruct it. We can find out, why did you feel that way about that? When Joe said that to you that way, as opposed to Mary saying it to you, you reacted this way. Yeah. And that's why being with them in the environment, sometimes you can pick up on that. So there's the feeling, there's the reaction, and that reaction can trigger a behavior that got them into trouble in the first place, for example. So we look at that. What was the inciting incident? What was the trigger? Why did you feel that way? Oh, you felt that way because you have all these underlying assumptions and biases that go back to your childhood, right?
Yeah.
Or that, and so you can't be a psychologist necessarily, but you can start to identify what the triggers of that emotional reaction were, what the assumptions are, bring them to the surface, understand their meaning, and then repurpose that reaction so that the next time that emotional reaction happens, you can say, oh, yeah, okay, don't go down this default path. Let's take our time and, you know, review how we can make this productive. Does that make sense?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. And I was going to add to that, that whenever people change jobs, right, or they make a decision to leave an organization, I said, having talked to, you know, lots of people over the years, I said, usually there's one conversation you can put your finger on where you emotionally decided, you may not have left and walked out at that moment, but you decided that you didn't want to be there anymore. And do you remember what that is? And I guess I'd say nobody has failed to answer that question in a way that says, oh yeah, I remember it was a Friday afternoon and my boss had called me in and we were talking about a certain problem and I just didn't like the way that we were going to go on that issue. So I think you're definitely onto something. Hey, I wanted to cover one other thing, knowing that we've kept you a long time here.
No,
I'm curious, and again, I said it in your introduction, but one of the things that you do is you're into the arts, you're into filmmaking, you've got guitars hanging on your wall. But I'm curious, from your perspective, what connection you make between, say, the performing arts and leadership and management and business. What's your take on that?
Wow, I don't know if I've been asked that before. Thanks for that. The Cliff Notes version might be this, Greg. And I'll use film as an example, which I've been passionate about and had my fingers in that pie for many, many decades. I think that everyone at work, and I'll use the work environment here, Greg, and you can transpose it to your personal life if you wish, but at work, every day, there's a story being told by you and by others. And in a good movie, for example, it starts out with, you know, the fade in, and that's you arriving at work. Something happens, good or bad, that's your inciting incident that triggers the protagonist, that's you at work, you know, the hero, going through something and then meeting a challenge, the conflict. And then over the course of the day or over the course of your career, you've got multiple acts, act one, two, and three, let's say. And act one could be the early emerging stages of your career, mid-career, and then into the twilight years of your career. And then you hit fade out, the end, right? the ultimate existential. So the connection for me is, what are the stories being told? What are the conflicts that are coming up that are making this story interesting, for better or worse, for the protagonist? Now, I don't get hired if there's no conflict, and I don't get hired if the inciting incidents are all positive and everybody's cheery. I get hired when act one conflict triggers ripple effects in the organization that impact productivity or the supply chain or, you know, anything in between. Right. And in a good story, it gets resolved by the hero becoming aware, self-aware, and understanding what their limitations are and all of that. So I could go down a deeper rabbit hole.
I think you've nailed it.
Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, no, you've nailed it. And I would think that, you know, people probably don't realize, unless you've studied it, that what makes movies and TV shows interesting to you, or documentaries even, is that it has to take you on a bit of an emotional roller coaster through that. If it was just a path of success and everything worked out just fine, it would be a boring movie, right? So you actually, and the same goes for your career. I like, actually, there's even another sort of deeper level to what you're saying, because you're helping people unpack the stories and the beliefs that they're having that are creating some of those outcomes and conflicts, and giving them alternative pathways, almost in a choose your own adventure sort of way. I also like that you said that people go through multiple stages in their career. I had that discussion with a group of plant managers recently in our new site leader development program. And I said, you know, what version are you at of being a leader right now? Because my guess is you started as a 1.0, a 2.0, 3.0. If you're like me, you're probably into 5.0 by now. And, you know, your physiology changes as a human being, your experiences shape you, things have greater context. So I think that, I never really thought about it till we discussed it here, how much basically the story of your career and the story of a movie are very much similar for most people. Nobody has a career in a life that just goes along smoothly without any hiccups in it. And like you said, what is the micro story that you're telling about that little blip that you had, or even about the peak? You know, because both stories could be accurate or inaccurate or a little bit of
absolutely
both.
And just to finish off on that point, you know, we talk about the protagonist, you, in your work story, but there's the antagonists as well, right? Mm-hmm. There's the antagonists that make the story interesting. And the right kind of antagonists, which could be your colleagues, coworkers, direct reports, et cetera, are the people that often shine the light back on you. So you have to confront your fears and all of that. So, yeah, I think there are direct parallels. And sometimes, Greg, sometimes by using that analogy in the work environment with them and saying, hey, this, you know, think of it as a movie, that in and of itself helps explore the truth a little bit more.
I remember, I know you're a fan of Masterclass, like those nice in-depth videos, and I've watched the Samuel L. Jackson and a couple of the other people talk about the acting, like what's involved in acting. And what's, I think, some of the most interesting films and movies, not that we can do another half hour on our favorite films and stories, but the favorites are where the protagonist is the antagonist, or the antagonist is the protagonist, in at least in their own mind, and to some degree, the films that make the bad guys look good, or at least reveal why their motives may be not all evil, it just adds layers to the characters. And I would say that that's true in business too. There's layers of character to yourself as a leader.
Absolutely. And Greg, if you'll permit me, because I know I don't want to abuse the time privilege, but you just reminded me of something. In the early days of my, when I was doing a lot more training work on site, I did a leadership training program where I actually screened the movie 12 Angry Men, the original 1959 version. And it was required screening, and I'd have popcorn in the room and all that. So we'd watch this movie, not too long, an hour and a quarter, an hour and a half. And afterwards, the whole object of the exercise, Greg, was to look through all 12 of those characters, all 12 of those jurors, and identify their leadership types. Mm. And I won't go down that rabbit hole, but what a fascinating exercise.
Oh, yeah.
So another application of, you know, the performing arts, because each one of those characters had a very distinct leadership style.
Yeah. Now, I've used up a lot of your time. I just wondered, is there anything that you maybe hope that I would ask or that you might want to share before we wrap up the interview?
I think you've covered the bases, Greg. The only thing maybe I'd leave as a comment is encouraging, you know, your audience, whether they're in whatever the level of their career is to remain intellectually curious. Never be satisfied with the status quo and ask yourself, do I have all the information I need to make informed decisions and judgments? And I think if you do that, you'll be well on your way to success.
So, Lauren, I do want to mention, I didn't bring it up earlier, I want to mention that having seen you on stage and at the Professional Speakers Convention, which, you know, at least when I've done the main stage, and I did actually at the convention that you organized as a fill-in, but what I'd say is that the work that you put into the couple of times that I remember vividly, one was in London, Ontario, and then there's another convention where the level of preparation that you did, because you did some really fascinating things using video of yourself, interacting with yourself, which to me is very high risk for an event that you weren't getting paid for. At least I hope you weren't, because I didn't get paid. But the reality is that, like, even on a free engagement, the level of work you went to, and I know it's been something that while you were president of the Canadian Association of Professional Speakers, you really encouraged or challenged people to up their game a little bit from, like, what is your theatrical presence? What is the level of preparation you're prepared to do to meet the needs of your audience? So I just wanted to acknowledge that. So if someone is going to hire Lauren, either as a speaker or as an advisor, just know that he's going to go all in. And so I, again, give you kudos for that. So again, I just wanted to say, Lauren, thank you for being our guest. Again, if you want to reach out to Lauren Kelton, his company is called ThinkShift. And the website is thinkshift.com. And of course, you can look up Lauren Kelton on LinkedIn as well. Lauren, thank you so much for being our guest on the Accelerating Operational Performance podcast.
Thank you, Greg. It's been an absolute privilege.
All right. Well, thank you for spending your time with Lauren and I on this episode. Remember that if we can be of any service to you, the best thing to do is to start a conversation with us. Let us come in and do a little bit of a deep dive in your organization and see how we can bring our talents to match whatever the challenge and opportunity is. And that starts by visiting our website at uniquedevelopment.com. So for now, I'll just say have a great day and all the success on your leadership journey.